Hello and welcome to podcast number 19 of the Embryology series. Hi, Irene.
Greetings all. How are we all? Hopefully everybody is happy, and it is a sunny day today, so I'm very happy.
Hey, I said there was a boycott on the weather. We're not allowed to talk about the weather.
I know, but it's just nice. Yeah, but the other thing we were going to talk about was the fact that I've been puking my guts out for a week, which isn't very nice.
Yes, but Scott Sigler's been helping you out with that.
Yeah, I do love him. He's been fantastic. He's got two on the go at the moment, Nocturnal and Infected.
I just finished Ancestor. I'm listening to Infected.
Yeah,
I think I've listened to the whole lot now. So why are you puking up all the time then? Why do you need Scott Sigler so much?
I need Scott and the toilet bowl because I am nearly 15 weeks pregnant.
Yay, how embryologically relevant.
Yay! Although, what I did realise was all the juicy stuff happens so far in advance. All the good stuff. By the time you can tell people and it's safe to tell people you're pregnant, all the good stuff's already happened and it's just getting bigger and bigger and, all that.
It's done, by 8 weeks when everything's formed. Well, that's 10 clinical weeks, isn't it? The first 10 are 12, 14 weeks.
Exactly, job's done. So,
congratulations, well done.
Thank you very much, thank you. I'm feeling a lot better today, so all is well with the world. And I'm going to start doing some more exercise because basically for the last 3 months I've done absolutely nothing. Have you been doing much lately?
Hang on, you're going to start exercising now that you're pregnant?
Yeah, more like swimming, and I did go on a bike ride the other day, but...
Yeah, swimming sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
Probably no 15-mile runs or anything, though.
No. The surf, is, I don't know, if it's nice and gentle, I might go in, but it's absolutely huge at the moment, so I'm giving it a miss.
Well, how dangerous is surfing? I don't know, because I don't surf yet.
Well, I mean, you could get a board in the stomach, but I'm not that bad, so I kind of can control it, so I'm all right, I'm fairly safe.
You get your own board in your stomach?
Yeah, well, sometimes.
How would you do that?
if you fall off. If you fall off and it's a windy day, you can get a board in all sorts of places. I've had an absolute cracker right between the eyes.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I didn't look very pretty for about 3 days. Boards are hard and you can lose control of them. But generally I'm okay, and that's why I'm being on the safest side, just going in when it's a nice, quiet, calm day, couple of foot, clean, that kind of thing.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, it's good for you, and it's a good distraction.
Well, autumn's here. I would say the weather's changed, but it hasn't really. It's been autumnal most of the summer.
Can't talk about the weather.
Sorry. I can talk about the seasons. Autumn's here.
I know, it's, like I said, today is sunny, so that's what I'm holding on to.
Yeah, so I started doing a bit of running, which is nice.
Do
a couple of half marathons, I think, next year. This golf malarkey makes you soft.
Finally, he admits it.
Yeah, it totally makes you soft. Not everybody plays golf, but there are a lot of older gentlemen with paunches who aren't as fit as maybe the pros look on the telly who generally play golf, so... Yeah, I reckon I can play golf and set some new PBs running at the same time.
Brilliant. Well, we'll keep up with that.
Golf as well.
Is it?
I reckon it'll help the golf. Yeah, being fit. It's hard. 18 hilly holes around my golf club.
Yeah, really hard. I can see how it is.
Okay, yeah. What's going on in Biddeford? Anything?
Biddeford is a fairly sleepy little town, although when we left last weekend there was a regatta going on, and tomorrow, big drum roll, Biddeford Carnival.
Carnival, excellent. So is that going, winding its way through all the streets, is it?
Oh, God only knows. We've got some friends coming down, there'll be nowhere to park, it's going to be an absolute nightmare, but hopefully I'll get some good pictures, maybe we can put them up on the next podcast or something.
Yeah, it'd be good, that'd be good to see.
Yeah, it'll probably be a bit of a giggle, so.
Top.
Brilliant. So, what are we going to talk about today,
Dr. Webb? The new students have started. They're embryology in a few weeks' time, and they seem like a very nice bunch. So hopefully they'll be catching up through the series of podcasts we've done so far, which covers most of the teaching course. But I think we're going to talk about the eye today, aren't we? So we're going to go outside that, what is included in the Swansea Medicine teaching course. We're going to talk about the development of the eye, but probably kind of at a medical student level. And it's pretty interesting as well. If you know the anatomy of the eye, then looking at the embryology kind of helps link some of these things together, make sense of some of these structures, I think.
Fascinating topic.
Yeah?
Brilliant.
So, the eye. How are we going to talk about the eye? Last week we were talking about germ layers, weren't we?
We discussed.
The germ layers involved.
Yeah.
And then the eye forms in two parts. It's kind of got the front part and the back part, isn't it? The back part is the retina and the eye, you know, most of the eyeball.
Yeah. And
you've got the front part, which is the lens and the cornea and the half the iris and all those bits. So let's talk about the back part first, then the front part, and then try and link it all together as the eye gets formed. And there probably aren't really that many congenital abnormalities that's worth talking about. There's one I can think of, but most of them probably don't help the listener understand the embryology of the eye much. So
we'll leave it at one. Okay, fair enough. Well, one of the first things that we should say about the development of the eye is that it does come from ectoderm. I think we did mention that in the last podcast.
The eye is part of the central nervous system, isn't it? It starts off, some of it does, so that's going to be neuroectoderm.
Correct.
Another part comes from ectoderm, and I think we have a bit of mesoderm in between, don't we? So it's mostly ectoderm. It's ectoderm and a bit of mesenchyme, a bit of mesoderm. And from the ectoderm, we've already got neuroectoderm, and we've got some neural crest cells involved as well, haven't we?
Yeah, and we've got that surface ectoderm as well. So when we describe the eye, you'll see where the surface ectoderm and the neuroectoderm come together.
Yeah, okay. So to start off talking about the eye, we need to start talking about the central nervous system, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, we've got the neuroectoderm, we've got the tube for the central nervous system.
And at the top part, we've got the different parts of the brain forming, and then that goes down, and then in the tail part, we've got the spinal cord.
Yeah, so the brain part, we've got swellings, haven't we? Kind of hollow swellings, bulbous bits, and it's all going to fold over to form the adult parts of the brain. So where do the eyes pop out from then? Pop out.
Okay, well, basically, the eyes form from out pockets of the forebrain. So if you think about where your eyes are situated, it makes sense that they're going to develop from the forebrain.
So the forebrain, is that the bit that's going to become the cerebral hemispheres?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Okay.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, they're going to pop out from that bit. So there's a couple of other swellings on either side for the left eye and the right eye then?
Basically, yeah. They call them optic grooves to start with, and then they develop a little bit more into kind of, like I said, these out pocketings, and they become optic vesicles. That's what we call them.
Right.
Of neuroectoderm, okay? So it's still
kind of like a balloon vesicle blowing up.
That's exactly right.
That's the shape we start with.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that there's always a connection to the brain. So these are outpocketings, but they don't bleb off. There is still a connection straight to the forebrain.
Right. Now that optic vesicle, if it starts off like a balloon, it changes to kind of like a round wine glass shape, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a good description.
So if you had the balloon, you'd kind of stick your fist into it.
Yes.
Push it so that it changed its shape into, difficult to describe this, to a kind of a round wine glass with those two layers.
Yeah.
Kind of got a deeper layer and a more superficial layer. We can probably throw some, you reckon you can do some drawings of this?
I think I can manage that. It's basically an invagination of that optic. We end up calling it. It goes from an optic groove to an optic vesicle to the optic cut. That's right, to the optic cut. And it's that, like you say, that wine glass effect, and it invaginates and pushes in, so you get the two layers.
That was the most similar object I could think of, the wine glass, because of course the stem is the link back to the brain.
Excellent, I like it. And
but there's a gap at the bottom, though, isn't there? There's a fissure at the bottom, a choroid fissure.
Yeah.
So it's not a perfect wine glass. It's a wine glass kind of with a groove cut out the bottom of it. And that extends down the stalk as well, doesn't it, back to the brain?
Yes.
So that part is going to become the retina, right?
Yeah.
And the optic nerve in each eye.
And
The adult retina, we don't really want to go into the adult retina here because it's a really nice complicated structure. If you can look at the histology of it, it's really interesting. But you've got two layers. So the deeper layer is the neuronal bit. The deeper layer is where all the sensors are.
Yeah.
The sensing cells and the nerve cells, which are then going to reach their axons back to the brain. And the more superficial layer is the pigmented layer, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So from this wine glass with the two layers, the more superficial layer of the, what did you call it? Not the optic vesicle anymore, it's the optic...
Optic cup.
So the more superficial layer of the optic cup, that's going to become that pigmented retina.
Yeah.
And the deeper layer is going to become the neuronal retina.
That's got all the rods and the cones in it and all that kind of stuff, if everyone remembers those from their anatomy.
Yep. So they start out as two separate layers. And I think Actually, this is a space reference, isn't it? Detached retina.
Say again?
Detached retina. So you can separate, in the adult, you can separate the pigmented layer from the neural layer. If you were a small boy and were pushed out of a tree by Simon Pegg's character in space.
Yes, now I remember.
And then can get in the regular army. So those two layers do become opposed to each other, and they do kind of stick together, but it's not like, you know, they're not like fused together like one future layer or anything.
No, and
so there's the embryological origins for that.
No, that's brilliant. And I mean, there's all sorts of things that we could go on about the rods and the cones and, you know, how incredibly impressive the whole setup is. But I think for this podcast, I don't think we need to go into that too much, do we?
No, but if the listener wants to dig up a histology textbook and look at the layers, especially the neural part of the retina, there's lots and lots of interesting cells there. Rods and cones. One does light and dark and one does colour. Which one's colour?
C for colour. Cones. Cones. C for cones, C for colour. Yeah.
I can never remember that.
There are like three types of them. It's absolutely brilliant.
Three types, yes. You've got like red, green and blue.
Yeah, short, middle and long.
I think there are, genetically speaking, there are two different types of green receptor. And some people can have an extra green. So you can have two greens and a red and a blue. And those are tetrachromatic people. And apparently, I think this is an X-link thing. So this is what some women have. And they're tetrachromatic. So like my missus can see umpteen shades of beige where I just say it's brown. I don't know whether she is tetrachromatic or not, but she doesn't have to see stuff I can't see. So the idea is you have three cones, but there are some interesting people. Look up tetrachromatic and Google, it's really cool. Where you have, you can see, we have four cones, four different shades, four different types of cones. I don't know how best to describe it, I don't know much about the eye. But different animals have different numbers of cones as well, so different animals can see different things, can't they?
Absolutely they can, and I don't know about cones, but I've got a little fact about rods, because rods are the low intensity. They do see colour, but just not as well, not half as well. So they're sort of, and they, because they see the low intensity light, they're the ones that we use more when the light's bad. So at night, owls have 100 times more rods than humans.
Wow.
I know!
Yeah, the whole rods thing is they're more around the outside, aren't they? So if you look at something directly, you can see the colour. If you look at something directly in the night, it's harder to see. But if you look at it just to the side of it,
you can see
it a bit better, can't you? Because you've got more.
Right. So if you're using your peripheral vision, you mean?
That's what I should be
saying. I didn't know that.
Have you tried that?
Thank you very much.
Boy Scout stuff. See that? Walking in the dark without torches. Yeah. Just look to the side of it, and you'll see it a bit better in your peripheral vision.
I like that. And
not very embryological, that. But hey.
No, and carrots help you see in the dark. Nothing new there. Why do they help you see in the dark? Because they've got beta-carotene in, and beta-carotene is the pro-vitamin of vitamin A. And you need vitamin A. Another name for a type of vitamin A is retinoic acid. Retina helps you see.
How does it help you see?
It's complicated.
Oh, is it?
Well, yeah, it involves rhodopsin. It involves a series of... Do you remember in chemistry when you have different forms of stuff and it's like cis and a trans form?
Yeah.
Well, basically there's a cis form of something, cis 11 blah blah blah, and that transforms to trans blah 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 blah, and rhodopsin's involved somewhere, and so it's retinoic acid, and bingo.
Wow, that's massively helpful. Yeah, brilliant. I understand it much better now. Thanks. Retinoic acid is involved in the light detection system of the rods and the cones. Is that safe to say?
You said it, yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah, and of course we met retinoic acid when we were looking at limb development, didn't we?
Yeah, and it's bad for limb development.
Yeah, so vitamin A, which is why you don't have huge amounts of vitamin A in the early stages of pregnancy, because retinoic acid, first found in the retina, retinoic acid is a, it's a signalling molecule which... organises some of the patterning of the cells in the developing limb. Find out more. Go back to that podcast.
Quite interestingly, in the eye, they did some experiments with retinoic acid deficient mice or something, and it's the ventral part of the eye that doesn't develop. So it's quite specifically the ventral part of the eye and the optic nerve that won't form if you haven't got vitamin A.
So that shows that there's a distinct diffusion gradient again.
Correct.
Right, so we've got so obviously all these cells we're talking about, they're derived from neuroectoderm then?
Yes.
Yep. Okay, so all the retinal stuff, that's neuroectoderm, that's the optic vesicle, which has become the optic cup. Oh, yeah, the optic, is it called the optic stalk?
Yeah.
The stalk going back. Now, okay. How does the optic stalk become the optic nerve? Now, you've got the cells, you've got the neuronal cells in the retina. So they then send their, they've got to send their axons back to the relevant parts of the brain, so it all gets wired up. So the stuff that the retinal cells are sensing, the light that they're sensing, is sent back to the brain so that the brain can perceive what the eyes are detecting, right?
Yeah.
So they, the cell bodies then are in the retina, and they send their axons back through the optic stalk.
Yeah.
And it becomes populated then with nerve fibers.
Yeah.
So it becomes the optic nerve.
Yeah. Wow. Genius.
We should probably talk about the choroid fissure there as well then, because that gap, the choroid fissure, that gap in the wine glass extends down the stalk.
Yeah.
And it's got two vessels in it, the hyoid vessels. So it's got the hyoid artery and the hyoid vein. And they're then blood vessels supplying blood to the layers of the retina. And also to the developing eye as a whole at the early stages, isn't it? And as the axons from the neural, the retinal neural cells extend back through the optic stalk, that fissure is lost. The optic stalk becomes a solid optic nerve, and the vessels become... the hyoid vessels become stuck in between all those axons, so they're within the optic nerve.
Yeah.
Which is what we see in the adult anatomy, isn't it?
Yeah. The choroid fissure begins to close at like just 7 weeks. So all the stuff's happening so early. So by 7 weeks, it's already beginning to close over.
It's
incredible.
Yeah, it's all done by 8 weeks. I mean, really, you only start to get, the optic cup... you start to get the really early signs of the optic cup is forming around 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Or the optic vesicle, certainly. The optic cup's around by 5 weeks.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, well, 6 weeks. It's all getting done by 7 and certainly by 8.
It's actually been...
late stages of the embryonic development, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say one thing that we should mention is because this optic nerve is a direct connection to the forebrain, and if you remember in your brain anatomy, the brain has various layers that of protection, the meninges. Okay, there's three in the brain. Okay, but because this stalk is a direct connection, it also has certain protective layers. Okay, and there are two that we need to mention here. Is that all right?
So yeah, okay. So around the brain, we've got the pia mater, the arachnoid mater, and the dura mater.
Yeah.
How does that translate to the eye then, if it's an extension of the developing brain?
Okay, well, essentially around the optic nerve, there are two layers. One is the choroid. One's called the choroid layer, okay? And that choroid layer can be directly linked to the pia mater, okay? So it's going to be a vascular layer.
So it's a vascular connective tissue-y layer holding it all together, right?
Yeah, and it is continuous with the pia mater, okay? And then the other one that we will need to mention is the sclera, okay? And the sclera is continuous with the dura mater in the brain.
So the sclera is the tougher, it's kind of, it's not, has all the blood vessels within it, it's a tough...
Yeah, it's a thick...
outer layer.
Yeah, thick layer. So those two we should mention.
Yeah, okay, thank you. So the cornea then is a specialised part of the sclera.
Yeah. It is, actually.
The cornea being the bit that you see through, the clear bit.
Mm.
I remember a little bit from the squidging bullseyes around GCSE.
Nice.
Yeah, I remember the sclera is pretty tough.
Yeah, before we... Yeah, exactly. I can as well, actually. You just brought back a flood of memories.
The sclera, actually, yeah, there's another point. So in humans, in most people, the sclera is white, isn't it? That's the white of your eye.
Yes.
But in, like, horses, it's black. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Cows,
no,
is
sheep.
It?
In sheep,
sheep
it's black.
Sheep is black. Horses is black. Cows? I think it's white in cows, isn't it? I remember a white bullseye.
Ask Scott Sigler, probably.
I feel back on the ancestor podcast here.
Yeah. One other thing, because we're just talking about the back of the eye. So one of the other things we need to mention is that massive space at the back, which is full of vitreous humour.
Yes.
But that's kind of like a massive part of the eye that we haven't mentioned yet. So carry on.
Yeah. No, so yeah, in the adult, that's the vitreous body. That's why you end up chasing the bullseye around the bowl with a scalpel, isn't it? Because the sclera won't let you penetrate it, and the vitreous body just kind of squidges like a bouncy ball and flies across the room, yeah.
It's really gelatinous, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's full of collagen. It's really gelatinous, and it's kind of holding it all. I guess. I mean, I need to speak to somebody who knows about eyes and optician. I go from optician. You have a what? A ophthalmologist.
Ophthalmologist. Yeah.
Yes, but the pressure in the eye is because to keep this sphere and the shape of the eye and what have you is linked to all this. But where does the vitreous humour come from? The stuff that the jelly stuff that films the vitreous body.
Brilliant question.
What makes that?
Dunno.
I think it's the cells of the retina.
Are there specialised cells in the retina? I think there might be.
I think there are some cells in the retina that make that.
Don't know what they're called.
Okay, so the back part of the eye then, all this stuff we've talked about in the vitreous body, that extends up to the lens.
Mm.
And the attachments of the lens to the sides of the eye. Because we all know the lens obviously can change shape, which helps us focus on things that are far or near.
Yeah.
So that's the back of the eye. All this neuroectoderm stuff that we've talked about so far goes up as from the back as far anteriorly as the lens. So where does the lens come from?
Well, I'm kind of hoping that it comes from the surface ectoderm.
Why are you hoping that?
No, it does. If you remember when we were talking about that optic cup coming out of the neuroectoderm, what actually happens is it touches the surface ectoderm. Okay, so I think there are interactions that go on.
So it's going to induce the overlying ectoderm.
Exactly.
To become specialised. Exactly. Which makes sense, because you wouldn't want your lens and your cornea and stuff to just start appearing somewhere where your eye isn't.
No, and what happens with this surface ectoderm, all these, God only knows what reactions are taking place, but the surface ectoderm blebs inside and we end up getting a lens vesicle come off from it. So I'll draw a diagram to show it really clearly because I didn't explain it that well, but you essentially have this lens vesicle that originates from the surface ectoderm.
So the cells on the surface ectoderm know they're going to become lens cells and they start to sink down and eventually bleb away from the surface ectoderm and form a flattened sphere. What's a flattened sphere?
I bet
Jack's learning this in his first year of school. What's a flattened sphere? That's the last disky thing, yeah, flying saucer, whatever shape that is.
Disc, yeah.
Yeah. Forms a shape like that, which is kind of the future lens.
Yeah.
So then that's between the neuroectoderm stuff, the optic cup, and the ectoderm.
Yeah.
Okay, what happens then? I know the adult lens is obviously clear, and being an articular cartilage biologist with an interest in collagen, I know that the lens is mostly made up of type 4 collagen.
So it's see-through.
It's got other collagens in there as well, but it's mostly type 4. I think the cell's probably mostly around the edge, so I guess that's going on in there. And I know that the lens is attached to the rest of the eye via the ciliary body.
Yes, and that helps change the shape, yeah? The ciliary muscle helps change the shape.
Yeah, so we have development of the ciliary body, and here we have the ciliary muscles. So there's a ciliary process, which is part of the optic cup, so part of the retinal layers. And the ciliary process and some of the underlying bits are going to become the ciliary body. And the ciliary muscle is, as you rightly said, going to be formed from the mesenchyme. Which is fairly normal, muscle, mesoderm, mesenchyme. So we have the ciliary muscle, and then the ciliary body and the ciliary muscle attached to the lens via suspensory ligaments, little tiny fibres. So as the muscle contracts and relaxes and stuff, it pulls and stretches and or lets the lens shrink back into a fatter shape. No, so it focuses the light on the back of the retina. So much of the ciliary body is formed from retinal bits, from neuroectoderm bits. But the ciliary muscle is formed from mesoderm.
I see.
So there we go. So we've got that optic cup and all the retinal bits. We've got the lens, we've got the ligaments, we've got the ciliary body. That's the back part of the eye. So the ciliary body is also making the aqueous humour. And the aqueous humour is going to fill the space between, in front of the lens, anterior to the lens, between the lens and the cornea. So it's different to the vitreous humour behind. That's another job I know of as a colleague. Body.
Yeah, and then, did you just say that it drains back into the blood supply?
I didn't, no.
Oh, it drains back into the blood supply. Because obviously, the blood supply, there's not blood vessels running backwards and forwards and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are blood vessels to the back part of the eye. Those hyaloid vessels we spoke of, which also initially started, they supply the retina and the developing lens and that sort of thing. But then they're lost later on in development of the eye.
Yeah, so the front part of the eye needs to get its nutrients from somewhere, and it is this aqueous humour.
Yeah, so the ciliary body makes the aqueous humour. So what have we got in the front part of the eye then? So we've got the lens, which we just spoke about.
Yeah, the ciliary body that we just talked about.
Ooh, we've got
muscle
the
and...
We've got the iris,
and we've got to cover the cornea as well.
We've got the cornea. So the cornea we kind of touched on. We've got the sclera, which is the outermost layer of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And the bit in the front of the eye is going to become specialised and becomes the cornea. Specialised because it's... A, it's transparent, so you can see through it. And B, because it's curved at a different radius to the rest of the eyeball to help focus the light onto the lens. So it's an important part of the function of the eye. Yeah, so that's how the cornea forms. The cornea forms from ectoderm. So what about the iris then?
Yeah, the iris, well... Okay, so it's a colour part of the eye, yeah? You get that part, okay? And it's basically a sphincter around the pupil of the eye, the pupil being your black bit where the light comes through, okay? So it comes through there to get to the retina. But the iris is I don't know, it's got its name because it's named after the colour, all that kind of stuff. But basically, its main function is not to look pretty.
probably a function, though, isn't it?
Yes.
A Desmond Morris type function. Sorry.
It's got pigmented tissue, okay, and that can be called stroma. And it's got these two types of pupillary muscles, okay? So it's got a sphincter pupillae, which contracts the pupil, and a dilator pupillae to open the pupil, okay? So it's all about controlling the light, the pupil aperture, if you like. That's a bit camera-y, isn't it?
No, that's exactly what it does, yeah.
And basically... it's got to have pigment content to concentrate that light so that the light can't get through the too much of the area. So not too much light can get through, that's what I'm trying to say. Interestingly, the pigment, guess what it is?
Melanin.
Yeah, it's exactly the same as in your hair and your skin and all that kind of stuff. It's got a slightly different structure.
It's the only pigment I can think of. Ah, hang on, this links back to last week. So then... Are there neural crest cells involved with this then, if we're talking about melanin?
There must be, because that's where melanin, melanocytes come from.
Excellent.
So, basically, the pigment is melanin. It's the colour of the eye doesn't just depend on melanin. It's also sort of the texture, how much is laid down, other fibrous tissues and blood vessels that are around that area. But putting it simply is that... the more melanin you deposit in your eye, the darker your eye colour is, okay?
Right.
So babies all have blue eyes because they haven't had the time to lay down enough melanin to darken the iris of their eye.
Oh, I see. So as they get older then, that's why the eye colour changes?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's it.
So, is the iris... Is it partly formed from ectoderm, partly formed from mesoderm? Or is it all mesoderm?
I think the sphincter pupillae and the dilator pupillae are both from mesenchyme.
Right.
And then obviously the pigment cells are from the neural crest.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so that's the anterior part of the eye then. So that aqueous humour we spoke about is coming from the ciliary body into the posterior chamber, which is the space between the iris and the lens. Passing through the pupil, so there's a proper hole there, into the anterior chamber, which is between the iris and the cornea, and then going back into the blood supply through that meshwork you mentioned.
Yeah.
Cool, okay. So, we've talked about the formation of the vitreous body, of the retina.
We've talked
about some of the blood vessels, we've talked about the lens, we've talked about the iris, we've talked about the cornea, we've talked about the muscles. I think we've covered everything we need to. There's one congenital thing which is worth talking about, which is coloboma.
Oh, yeah.
Which has been, it was in the press last year because when Madeleine McCann was kidnapped, it was noticed that on her photo she had a coloboma in her left eye or a right eye, something like that. So people suddenly realised what a coloboma is. So a coloboma is, normally it's a gap in the iris. So instead of the colour going all the way around, there's a gap in the bottom of the iris where it's black outside the pupil.
It's that...
Go on.
I was going to say it most commonly affects the iris. That is the mo- there are loads of different types of it, but it is most common that it just affects the iris. Karen.
Yeah, you, I mean you can get a gap in the eyelid and all sorts, but it's caused by the choroid fissure that we spoke about earlier. That gap in the wine glass structure not closing. So it's supposed to close. You have a so you have a properly round eye. If it doesn't close, then you have this gap in the iris. You have a coriboma. Yeah.
And it will affect vision because too much light can get through.
Right, yeah.
To the retina. So, and apparently there's not really any treatment for it either. So. And it's not very common.
No, most of the other congenital defects I'm aware of. Maybe we should get an ophthalmologist or somebody to have a chat about this. But most of the other congenital defects I've seen, I don't know that they link very well to the embryology. I don't know how well understood they are.
No, I've had a look through and... Nah, to be honest, there's various things like congenital cataracts and things like that, but and the only link with that is mothers who've had rubella during pregnancy. But the others, the others are very different to that.
I mean, going to the other end of the life scale, I know there's an interesting thing about the cornea at death. Us being anatomists and working with lots of dead bodies and what have you, is that the cornea is cloudy after death. I don't know how true this is. This is on Wikipedia, I think, and it wasn't referenced. But the idea is that you've got that circulation of aqueous humour, so it's taken back into the blood supply. And after death, that circulation, that uptake back into the blood doesn't occur, so the cornea absorbs some of the aqueous humour, and as it absorbs it, it goes cloudy. And if you take the cornea out and dry it out and keep it warm, it clears up again. Don't know how true that is, but...
little experiment.
Maybe not, but it's certainly something we observe, isn't it? You can see there's a difference in the young eye, in the older eye, and certainly in the eye of a body that you're dissecting.
Yeah, that's definitely
interesting.
Very.
Anyway, okay. I think
brilliant.
Covered everything.
I think we have. I think that's everything. Even if I had anything else to say, can't be bothered. It's not interesting enough.
Well, we did get away from the embryology quite a bit, I think, because the rest of the eye is so interesting. So
it is. I think it's absolutely brilliant, and because special senses are so interesting, we're going to try and do another special senses podcast, I think, next, aren't we?
Do the ear, shall we?
I think that would be a good idea.
So we can talk about falling over and listening.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds perfect.
It's probably
so
really relevant to a podcast.
What is?
Listening.
Yeah, unless people switch off.
Yeah, I should be able to link that in somewhere. Right, okay, well, thank you, Ree.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, I've learned something.
Yeah, I've had a good podcast. Enjoyed that.
Yeah, okay, cheers. Okay, right. Well, see you next time, everybody.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.